Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Turkish travels, traumas, and triumphs. Returning home from an educator's tour of Turkey, three Anchorage teachers and a UAA professor share what they learned abroad and how it will be incorporated into their Anchorage classrooms. An affiliate of the World Affairs Council of America, the Turkish Cultural Foundation organized the first teacher study tour to Turkey this past summer. Close to 100 educators from around the United States were selected to take an educational tour of Turkey, including Istanbul, Marmara, Aegean, and Central Turkey. From Alaska, Alex Bortnick, a teacher at East High School, Irene Bortnick, a kindergarten teacher in Anchorage, John Trampush, a social studies teacher, and April Suski, a professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, were selected to participate in the program. All of the teachers discuss what they learned on the teacher study tour and how they plan to use what they learned to enhance their classroom curriculum in Anchorage. Recorded on Friday, October 3rd, 2008, at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, today's program has been edited for broadcast. You can view the photos and slideshows presented by the teachers on our website, kska.org. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Turkish Travels, Traumas, and Triumphs.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Alex Bortnick. I'm a teacher at East High School. And together with my colleagues here, we were fortunate to go to Turkey on an educator's tour through the Alaska World Affairs Council and the Turkish Cultural Foundation. And it's my understanding this tour is being applied for the summer of 2009, so four additional teachers from the Anchorage School District might be able to get there. We were part of a team of 28. There were seven groups, if you will, of four each, 28 on a bus. The map up here, and I will not go through it in great detail, but you will be seeing some pictures along the way. We landed in Istanbul, which is to the top left of the map of Turkey, proceeded by bus. On the map to the west, southwest, we made a number of stops, and I won't go through all these stops. We went to Bursa, which was the first Ottoman capital and the silk capital of the world, down to Ephesus, very famous ruin, both a Roman, a Greek city and then a Roman city. And then we swung toward the heartland, Aphrodisias, a number of other rooms, Çatal Hayek, which is in the lower right corner of our route there, is the largest Neolithic city, about 8,000 people and about 7 or 8,000 years old. And we had guides all the way taking us through these ruins. Our guide in Çatal Hayek was Professor Ian Hoder, who is a Stanford professor, and he's the chief or lead archaeologist on the site. Up to Cappadocia, I couldn't begin to describe that. I think you only see it in kind of Disney movies or some kind of make-believe. It has very unique geological formations, and people used to live in the rocks. They would carve homes into the limestone formations. Nearby, there's actually whole cities where early Christian communities would go in underground and live in these caves in times of conflict. And then up to Ankara, which is, of course, the capital. You see that center of the map in Turkey, and spent several days getting there. Of course, it was about a week and a half trip, and then we flew back to Istanbul and on home. We will tell you a number of things about the trip, but without further ado, I'm going to pass the mic to my wife, who will tell you about some connections she made with schools in Turkey and some of her observations.
Okay. Merhaba. You might be wondering how a kindergarten teacher came to be included in a study tour of Turkey that consisted primarily of high school social studies teachers. Firstly, any experience that enriches one's life on a personal level adds to one's strength as a teacher. Secondly, social studies, particularly learning about other people and cultures, is a big part of Montessori education, and I am a Montessori teacher. Montessori believed that the road to world peace was through learning about other people. Thirdly, along with a colleague who is here tonight, I do annual social studies presentations at the Anchorage Association for the Education of Young Children Conference. Through these avenues, I hope to disseminate information about Turkey. So how will I use these insights and knowledge I gained during the tour of Turkey in my classroom? When we study other countries, we invite guests in to speak about places they have lived or visited. I will be able to do a slideshow of Turkey, not just for my class, but also for other classes in our school. For instance, our buddy class, and that teacher is also here tonight, will be studying the Middle East in the spring, and I hope to do a presentation for them. We also bring in artifacts such as the ones you saw displayed on the table as you entered. Cooking and tasting foods from around the world is a big part of our curriculum, and so I'm going to show you a series of slides about the food. Turkey, of course, is known for its various kinds of kebabs. We tasted many delicious eggplant dishes and a salad of chopped tomato, cucumber, and parsley sprinkled with crumbled goat cheese is popular. Baklava and other desserts soaked in honey were commonly featured, and everyone loved the cherry juice that came with every meal. Fortunately, we walked a lot, so we didn't gain too much weight. Dried fruit is a big industry and is sometimes advertised as natural Viagra. Of course, I will not tell the children this. Since we grow mint in the classroom, it will be easy to make decaffeinated mint tea for the children, and they will enjoy chopping the vegetables for a salad. We might also make börek, a pastry filled with cheese and spinach or potatoes, or pita, known here as pita or pocket bread. And there's a slide of a woman in a restaurant that we visited, and she is making it right there in front of us. It was delicious. All kindergartners learn about the senses, and so we will go on a little tour of the Spice Bazaar, which dates back to the 16th century. And I will bring in samples of spices, such as you saw on the artifact table, to see, smell, and taste. And even one of the rest stops on the drive had a mini Spice Bazaar. We will also listen to samples of Turkish music and look at pictures of the different instruments, such as the shown here, the different instruments played. And here you see a man playing a specific instrument of Turkey with a parrot on it, and this was at one of the restaurants, and there's a fun story about the restroom at this restaurant that Alex loves to tell, so he's going to come tell that story.
Right. We're not going to inflict a lot of stories about bathrooms while you're eating in Turkey, but this is a unique story. We're on the road. I think we were in Nicaea, and we were on the road, middle of nowhere, going one place to another, and we stopped in at this great restaurant. We sat down. We had a great meal. The parrot would jump on and off. He's not tied down, but he would jump on and off of the instrument. And we had been exposed to a variety of facilities in Turkey, but this one is unique. This place, I think the common term was you could chill here for a while. There were like Japanese gardens and very spotless porcelain facilities there. And there's this big newspaper article indicating why this bathroom was so famous. Turned out when the guy built the restaurant, he couldn't get a permit to build a bathroom because the mayor wouldn't give the permit because he hadn't voted for that mayor. So he had to wait for a while, and then when a new mayor came along, he got his bathroom, and he decided he's going to build the best one in Turkey, and he really did. So we saw.
At another restaurant we visited on the Bosphorus, we were treated to a four-person band playing classical music. And if you would like to get more information about the music, art, culture, anything to do with Turkey, history, archaeology, this site of the Turkish Cultural Foundation will lead you to a number of different places where you can get really good information. And they even have samples of music with pictures of the instruments that you can show and play. Art is another important part of the curriculum. When the children do pottery lessons with the art teacher, we'll look at photos such as these from the tile factory, and I'll bring in the trivet that we purchased. They can try their hands at painting some of the designs, which I have prints of, but they will, of course, be simpler than the ones here. We'll also look at the photos from the pottery workshop we visited in Cappadocia. And so here is a picture of the entrance to this workshop, which has a new facade, but it was built into a cave, which provides good, cool, controlled environment. This has been a family business for 200 years. And the man in the slide who is showing off some of the plates they make, it's his family. This plate was absolutely beautiful, but way beyond our means. Another art form is Ebru, which is an ancient Turkish art form still practiced today, and it's marbling. We will try to do an adapted form of this in our classroom, since I'm not sure we can find ox bile very readily. The marbling effect is achieved by adding drops of color pigments into a pan of oily water. Designs are made by drawing a stylus through the paint, as you saw the woman in the slide doing, and dragging it through the water. Paper is carefully laid on top and then lifted. Traditionally, marble painting was used in conjunction with calligraphy in the writing of treaties and was also used for the end pages of books. And we got to try our hands at this, and this is a little piece of the one that I helped to make. And there's a card up front, and I think April brought some things from the marbling place. Then shadow theater has been a big part of Turkish culture since Ottoman times. Puppetry is a great way to get young children to use oral language and to retell stories, an important element in a balanced literacy program. During our free time in the Kaza Khan, which was the home of the silk trade and now is a market, Alex and I and another teacher were entertained by one of the shopkeepers with an impromptu shadow puppet show. While buying a magnet depicting the famous shadow puppets, I mentioned that we would be seeing the show that night. The owner immediately told us to sit down as he sent one assistant out for tea, and another picked up his tambourine and began playing while he himself pulled down a screen, turned on a light, and began to tell a story. Though none of us could understand the words, we followed along and thoroughly enjoyed it. That night, we visited the official theater with its wonderful museum and were instructed on how the shadow puppet theater works and sort of other things about it. The children will be able to make their own puppets, sort of, and we can rig up a theater so that they can tell their stories. And this man that you see in the slide, he does the entire puppet show, all the puppets, all the manipulation, and telling the story all by himself. It's quite amazing. One of my personal highlights came at the 11th hour when I was able to meet with the only trained Montessori teacher in Turkey. Osnur, the young lady in the picture with me, and I had only about 30 minutes together before I had to rejoin our group for our farewell dinner. But there was an immediate bonding of kindred spirits. Unfortunately, there was not enough time for me to visit her school, but we sat and talked and made a connection and planned to continue via the internet, because mail is a little iffy, to continue our connection, do some collaborating. Since our return, Osnur and I have exchanged several emails, and my class has dictated a story about our classroom and our school, which I've emailed to her. Of course, she is going to have to translate that for her children, then have them write something and translate it and send it back to us, so it may take a little while. But we plan to teach them, even at a kindergarten level, about Anchorage, about Alaska, and then hopefully to learn something about Turkey from them. I am grateful to the Turkish Cultural Foundation and to the Alaska World Affairs Council for giving me this opportunity, and I hope that other elementary school teachers' applications will be considered in the future. While you're waiting to visit Turkey, which I hope every single one of you will do, you can still teach about its rich history and culture. Again, the Turkish Cultural Foundation website is a great source of information. There are also many books, as well as some CDs, DVDs, and even maps available in our public library, which I found out when I couldn't sleep at 3 o'clock this morning. And our school libraries also have information. So thank you, Tekshaker Ederim.
Following his wife, Alex Bortnick, a teacher at East High School, returned to the podium.
I'm going to briefly go over some of the information I was interested in secondary school. So I'll tell you a little bit about the Turkish educational system. To start off with, it's compulsory through middle school. They start at first grade. That's mandatory. Kindergarten is not mandatory, but very common. Preschool is also common. And they go from age 6 to 11 to elementary school, grades 1 through 5. Then they move on to a mandatory middle school, grades 6, 7, and 8. That's the end of the mandatory education. A large number of students will go on to high school, of course. They have to take an exam for high school. And high school is 3 years, grades 9, 10, and 11, unless you're going to a Voc Tech high school, which is a fourth year, usually. Schooling is very interesting because, in one way, they use the school system to promote secularism in Turkey. And they do it through religion courses. So that was naturally rather interesting to me. It turns out that if you read the history, when the Republic was founded right after the First World War, the Ottoman Empire was terminated. In 1924, they passed a Unity of Education Act because there were four types of schools that were very common in Turkey at that time. There were religious schools, madrasas. There were Ottoman-founded public schools modeled on European systems called mekteps. There were minority schools. The Armenian population had their own schools. The Greek population had their own schools. The Jewish population had their own schools. And there were schools that were run by missionaries. All the madrasas were abolished. No religion was permitted until after World War II. And the Ministry of Education, or Ministry of National Education, controlled everything, all the textbooks and so forth. After the Second World War, 1949 actually, there was a desire to put in some religious instruction in the public schools. Very controversial then, still is today. But it was all done under the national government, under the ministry. So they controlled the content of all textbooks being used. It came at the request of parents, and they put in one course. It was about an hour a week, perhaps 2 hours a week in some schools. And it was really a comparative religion course and an ethics course and a civics course more than anything else. You could take this course if your parents signed a special paper saying they wanted you to take it. In the mid-50s, they expanded the course to a couple of additional years, made it mandatory unless your parents signed a form saying they didn't want you to take it, and then you're off the hook. And then they cut to the chase. They basically expanded this over the years. Every few years they changed things until it became, as it is today, a course on the knowledge of religion, the knowledge of culture, or the culture of religion and ethics, and it starts in the fourth grade and continues all the way through the end of high school. It's a course that is at least 50% comparative religion, ethics, principles, things of that sort. It's not exactly religious instruction. Another thing that's very interesting is that in this course, there are a lot of quotes by Mustafa Kemal, by Ataturk, and then there are quotes from the Quran to show that Ataturk was consistent with the Quran. So all of the sayings that Ataturk had, consistent with the Quran. So that's very interesting. That course is taught usually an hour a week or 2 hours a week, depending on the level of school. It goes from the fourth grade through the 11th grade. Very interesting program there. Today, there are four types of high school in Turkey. And really, the schools are, in terms of the content of instruction, similar to our own. The one difference I noticed was that, like some other countries in Europe, Russia in particular, they will teach more subjects. You might, instead of 6 subjects, take 12 subjects, but you'll take them over 2 years. You might have geometry and algebra 2 over 2 years together, instead of 1 year algebra, 1 year geometry, that kind of thing. So you have in the... At the end of 2 years, you have roughly the same amount of instruction that we would have in the high school, and roughly the same subject matter. The four high schools today, they have a regular comprehensive high school like East, South, West, Diamond, Chugiaki, whoever, so forth. They have a Voc Tech school, I don't think it's quite the same as King Career Center, but they have VocTech training for a number of vocational programs, generally four-year high schools. And then they have the Imam Hotep High School, which is a comprehensive or regular high school, imagine like East or West High, with some amount of religious instruction. And the numbers started skyrocketing in terms of enrollment, particularly in rural areas. And so the Ministry of Education was watching this, and they decided that for whatever reason, there's too much interest being shown here. Used to be if you graduated from these kinds of high schools, which are located throughout the country, you could go to university and take anything you wanted. And so the parents, a lot of parents, particularly in rural areas, wanted their students, their sons and daughters, to get a regular high school education but have some amount of religious instruction. They changed the rules recently, a few years ago. You can only now go to the Department of Divinity at a university if you've graduated from one of these high schools. And the numbers drop way, way down. They also have a fourth type of school, which I want to end on, called an Anatolian high school. And that is a regular high school, but it's taught in English. In order to get into that school, you have to take a test, sometimes a lottery, and then you have to take a year off between middle school and high school and study English only for 30 hours a week. Total immersion, one full year. And if you pass the grade and pass the test, you go to the regular high school, I mean you go to an Anatolian high school, all the subjects are the same, but they're not taught in Turkish, they're taught in English. There are a couple of schools in that teach in French, and I think one or two in German, primarily English. And these kids really know English pretty well. So that was a fascinating kind of thing. This is a picture of Roberts College. Roberts College is a private high school, and it's in Istanbul, very famous, very well known. You will see the Turkish flag flying proudly over every school, at least one and sometimes more. This is a very famous school. It's my last picture. This isn't the last picture, but we'll come back to this school. This is a private, very wealthy boarding high school for gifted orphans. The deputy chief of staff of the Turkish Armed Forces is a graduate of this high school. The program of studies is similar to any high school. A lot of Americans go there for a one-year contract. That might be something some teachers might be interested in doing for a year. You can stay more than 1 year, but the contracts are for 1 year renewable. So we met and were taken around the school by an American, Robert Grindel, who's one of the teachers there. He's now in the administration there. It's co-ed, girls in their girl wing, the boys in the boys wing, and they are all orphans, and they are gifted, all gifted orphans. They're tested and sent here, and they go back to their orphanage for holidays. This is a typical uniform for a village school, very simple, but they all wear uniforms there. You'll see in every classroom a photograph of Ataturk, Mustafa Kemal, the Turkish flag, and some sayings. And it may vary, it may be a different photo, but every school will have this. Just where we have the American flag and the Alaska flag, you'll see this in every single classroom. This is a photo of a typical classroom in that orphan's boarding school. And you can see some of the students there. We just kind of walked in. They were still in session. It looks a bit sparse. They were getting ready for vacation. A lot of the books are off the shelves. That's typical furniture. This is a village school. Not quite as nice. We stopped in at a public village school in the middle of nowhere. And they still have the desks. They were not in session at the moment, so things were pushed to the side. Very sparse, old-style desks and benches, calendars, but they do have computers. They have this is a library of a private school. We were having a briefing there about education. So it's a typical high school library, but it's a private school. Private schools are funded by private foundations. They generally are better equipped. To conclude, we've established some connections by email, and I hope to have my students in high school talking in real time using an internet program such as Skype with a camera on it so they can actually see the students, their students can see ours, and have some discussions in English, because this is the English language Anatolian high school. And we'll discuss things like Turkey's going into the EU and Ottoman history and so forth. And we're glad to take questions at the end, but now I'm going to turn it over to Professor Suski.
Thank you. I'm April Suski. I'm term assistant professor of political science at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And although this program is not normally geared towards college-level teachers, like Irene, I'm also fortunate that I was accepted into this study tour for this last summer. It was incredibly lavish. The food was an unending, you know, smorgasbord of fabulous foods, breakfast, lunch, dinner. The hotels were the very best of the best, and if at all possible, if you can apply for this and go, you really should go. You won't believe how wonderful it is. I found that I could give the benefit of my experience to my students in a number of ways. I teach American government and political philosophy for the most part at UAA, although my colleagues teach comparative politics and international relations, and I'm hoping that I can make contributions to their classes as well. I'm also interested in comparing secularism and state formation in the United States and Turkey. I find it very interesting that in the United States, our concept of secularism is that religion and the state must be separated, that there's a wall of that Jeffersonian wall of separation that keeps them apart, and we very zealously guard that separation. Whereas in Turkey, what they have done following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and World War I, following Ataturk's direction, they have used the state to guide and direct religion from so that it does not become overpowering and so that it does not overwhelm the state. Therefore, you see, as Alex was telling you, you see that that religion is taught in the schools. Also, because the population is 98% Muslim, I should tell you that already. It's very, very high proportion Muslim, and the mosques are paid for through public funds. This is something that would be just anathema to us in the United States. We would never consider that. But the goal is the same, which is to make it possible to have a public life in which religion and politics exist side by side. To me, that's a very interesting comparison that I would like to pursue further. Also, in my role as a professor, I guide student clubs, and I also am interested in community outreach with organizations. And I'll tell you just a little bit about the very interesting organizations that we were introduced to. This is a typical type of thing that I might introduce to my American government class. The framers of the Constitution of 1787 were actually very influenced in three major ways by the Lycian League, which was a confederation that existed between about 126 BC to just near the collapse of the Roman Empire. And Lycia is located in southwest Turkey. A very beautiful, beautiful area. I'll show you a few pictures from that area pretty soon. At any rate, the Lycian League fixed up a system in which all of the participating cities, some of which were larger, some of which were smaller, could enter into their confederation, and they would be accorded the amount of power in that confederation based on the size of their population, which is very similar to the proportional representation that we have in the House of Representatives. And when at the Constitutional Convention, it was not believed that that kind of, you know, sophisticated melding of power could be achieved, Madison pointed to the example of the Lycian League. This is something that people in Turkey can be rightly proud of. Also, the idea of representation as a form of popular government rather than direct democracy, that worked quite well in the Lycian League. And also, the Lycian League, even though it was a confederated state, which means power sharing between a strong national government and other separate governments, the national government had the ability to make laws that national government could then apply directly to the individual citizens of Lycia. And so these are three principles of constitutional life that made it into our Constitution. We know from the proceedings of the convention, and we know from those proceedings that the example of Lycia was directly responsible. And so I think that it's very interesting to bring that kind of a connection into our classrooms at the university level. You know, other things that we might think about are the fact that our relationship, the United States' relationship with Turkey, is actually a very strong one. There is a congressional caucus. I think there's some 143 members of this caucus, and they promote legislation that promotes the relationship between Turkey and United States. And they also have an Turkish-American congressional internship program. And the policy cooperation areas, the two that are at the very top, of course, right now, are terrorism, cooperation for terrorism, and Middle East stability, and also energy, something that I think Alex was telling, weren't you telling us about that yet? I believe that's coming up later. Okay, that's a little taste of what's coming up in the future. Philosophy. As a teacher of political philosophy, I'm really very excited to bring in some philosophers that I was fortunate enough to be able to learn about. And I wanted to show you some of the culture that you will see if you go to Turkey. You will be amazed at all of the different kinds of landscapes and the art that you will see. You'll see lots and lots of statuary. So if you've ever wanted to go to Greece and look at the statuary at Greece, why not go to Turkey and look at it there? It's a very, very nice place to be, and you will have a wonderful time if you're interested in art and art history. This is the mausoleum of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, as Alex was telling you, founder and first president of the Republic of Turkey. And this, the courtyard extends out almost, it looks almost like a sea. This is such a classical-looking building. The proportions there, I think, are just beautiful. It reminds me almost of the Parthenon in its proportions. And inside, it's a very quiet, meditative space with a sarcophagus at the end, although he's buried way down below. All of this to commemorate their George Washington, almost. I think that Atatürk is very similar. His picture is not only in every classroom, it's in every street, it's in many homes. I mean, the pictures of Atatürk are everywhere. It's almost a cult of personality, but I think it's because he was so essential for the foundation of their republic. This is a list of Turkish civic organizations, many of which focus on the welfare of women and children, also environmentally concerned programs. This fellow right here, the highlight of my trip was going to hear this fellow, whose name is O. Faruk Logolu, who is the former Turkish ambassador to the United States for 2001 to 2006, and he gave us a fascinating discussion of United States-Turkish relationship, and it was wonderful to hear from his point of view what are the benefits of the relationship between Turkey and the United States. He also spoke a lot about why Turkey should be admitted into the European Union and why it was in our interest to help them succeed. This is our fabulous guide, Orhan Sezener, who is a fount of knowledge. And if you apply for this trip and if you go, you must bring a voice recorder, because I wish that I'd had one so that I could have recorded his lectures. He was like a college professor, and you will just learn so much. I don't know if they would have the same guide or not. This is my favorite shopkeeper. Isn't he friendly looking? The people are so friendly there. You'd just be really amazed. All of the shopkeepers, the people that you meet in the streets, they're so full of warmth and good humor and playfulness. They love to spend the time with you talking about things. You just won't believe. And they love Americans, too. That was another thing that was really refreshing. You tell them you're from America, they're happy to meet you. You know? And this is my favorite picture of the seagull. And with that, I'm going to give it over to my colleague, John Trampush, who has some very interesting thoughts to share with you.
Well, like everybody else that spoke before, I'd like to say thank you again to the Turkish Cultural Foundation and the Alaska World Affairs Council for providing Alaska teachers with this opportunity. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it opened my eyes to many things. I used to be a world history teacher and a world geography teacher, but now I work in the social studies curriculum department for the district. And so I focused my thoughts on similarities and contrasts that might provide interesting dialogue and discussion for projects between any level of teacher across Alaska and Turkey. And so I think that when you look at two places that have a lot of similarities, sometimes the differences really point you to your own culture. And I think that there's a number of ways in which Turkey and the United States are surprisingly similar, and yet in the differences you can learn about the United States as well as Turkey. And so that's kind of where I want to focus my attention tonight. The first thing that struck me, and it struck me very powerfully, surprisingly, was that Turkey really is a melting pot culture, just like United States is conceived of as a melting pot where various traditions and cultures have come together to make a new system. Turkey is amazingly mixed culture. The history of Turkey is such that there has been waves and waves of migration into Turkey, but not just for hundreds of years, but for thousands of years. Before you know, you start with the indigenous people, and then there was a wave of Mesopotamian expansion into the area with the Akkadian Empire. And then the Greeks established pretty much the entire coast of Turkey was Greek. The Persians, the Hittites, the Romans, and all those cultures didn't just visit. They stayed there for hundreds of years, mixed with the people that came before, and all this happened before the Turks came. The Turks didn't come till only 1,000 years ago. But all these cultures have been mixing and creating something that's blended and quite different. If you look at the pictures of in the museums of the Turks, when they came, you can just see that they were very, very Oriental. Turkey is named after a very, very Oriental people that came out of the Central Asia. And when they came, they were very nomadic. They learned to adapt to the city life, but they brought in a lot of help from the Persians. So when the Turks came in, there was another wave of Persian, because the Persians were to the Turks what the Indians were to the British Empire. They were administrators and organizers. And so it's very interesting to see all these waves of migration blending until you get what's basically just a Mediterranean amalgam, where you can tell you're looking at people that are from near the Mediterranean, but you couldn't pin it down to any particular quality. And I thought that was very interesting. It reminded me of the United States quite a bit. Another thing that that took me by surprise, even though I didn't go to Turkey with any preconceptions, I really didn't expect to see a place quite so industrialized, so modern and urban. It really is surprisingly similar to the United States in a lot of ways, at least in the parts of the country we had a chance to visit. I suspect if you went farther east toward the heart of Asia, it might look a little different. But what we saw was extremely, extremely industrial. There are over 70 million people in Turkey. It's giant. It's about the size of, Turkey has about as much land as Texas. But there are 70 million people there, which means the only countries in Europe that have more people are Germany and Russia, but Russia straddles two continents. So Turkey is a very large country, and it is also very industrialized. The economy there, you know, of all the nations in the world, Turkey has the 16th largest economy. That really blew me away when I found that out. You don't think of Turkey that way. I didn't have much of a concept of Turkey at all before I went. But it's very very modern and industrialized, and it took me by surprise. Istanbul itself, you could spend a month, a year in Istanbul, never leave the metropolitan area, and every day see history, culture. There's 12 million people living in Istanbul right now. In 2010, it's the European cultural capital. There are so many ancient ruins and Islamic museums that it's mind-boggling how interesting that place is. And it's a very open city. There seems to be an ability to travel there freely and find ways to communicate in English. As with Turkey in general, Istanbul straddles two continents. Here's one area where it really struck me where it was different than the United States. We have grown up as a nation with an ocean on both sides of us, kind of isolated. Turkey has grown up, spent its existence as a crossroads between continents where waves and waves of people are continually moving. It's not only a crossroad between land, but it's a crossroad between the Mediterranean world and the world of the Black Sea. So Turkey is a bridge between continents. And so there's a difference in an attitude there in some ways. The other thing that really struck me, especially being a long time in Alaska, was the density of the housing. I could not believe how dense people lived there. We're used to single-family dwellings as the rule, but I think three, four, five, six-story apartments were the rule there. And everywhere you went, people were living in each other's close spaces, so that creates a different mentality about neighborhood and community. And I think that would be really interesting to explore. I think there's a lot of conversations that that students could develop around just attitudes of community and individuality and neighborhood. And so that density was just you could stand in many cities, and I did, on a high hill, and just do a 360-degree spin, and everywhere you look, you see apartment next to apartment next to apartment, as far as the eye could see, and it just boggled my mind. The smaller towns were also very modern. You know, sometimes you think, well, that's the city, so that's natural. It's got to be advanced. But the smaller towns in Turkey were also extremely organized and modern-looking. And again, I didn't have an expectation, but I must have, because it took me a little by surprise. And the same applied to the countryside. The countryside was very developed. The agriculture was industrialized, and there was a lot of irrigation, and you could tell that, you know, they were used to the pretty much the same system for organizing their agriculture as we were, and that was very interesting to me. The other thing about the way the cities and the culture were is I was again surprised how European it looked. There was places where if you didn't look at the signs, you might have thought you were in Tyrolia or Bohemia. And I found that fascinating. One difference between Turkey and the United States, another difference, was the way that the past and the present live right next to each other so powerfully. You could see examples of 21st century modern life right next to ancient ruins everywhere. And I can't help but imagine that that creates a situation where you grow up with a different way of looking at time. You look at the present and the future different when you have 500-year-old buildings that are sitting next to your shop or where you live. And sometimes 500 is not even close. So there are lots of sites where there were 1,000-year-old mosques and 2,000-year-old ruins and 3,000-year-old ruins. And it was just mind-boggling to be around such an ancient land that had such a modern feel to it. And one of the things about America is that we live very much in the present moment and the immediate future, the quarterly report, and the instant gratification. And I can't help but think that when you are used to spans of time like this, it might change the way you look at things. Another thing that struck me as a similarity was the way Turkey invested in transportation. The way they went, and there's a lot of choices, and a lot of places in Europe didn't go this way, but the way they went was the way America went, heavily into the highway system and the internal combustion automobile industry. Turkey has its own Detroit. It was Konya, I believe. And they have an extremely well-developed highway system. Even the back roads, the country roads, again, if you go farther east, I'm sure it gets a little different. But in the major area where most of the people are living, the highway system and the infrastructure and the gas stations and the cars are all modern and all very developed. And that was a choice they made. And another choice they made is, even though they have coast on three sides, even though they got the Black Sea, the Sea of Marmara, the Aegean, the Mediterranean, it's all right there, they do most of their shipping via truck. They have 700,000 trucks in Turkey, which means they have more trucks than the whole rest of the European community put together. So they have trucks and they have a highway system just like we do. And so consequently, when you go into the towns and stuff, it's really easy to move around and you see cars everywhere. But as gas prices are going up, they're facing a very similar situation to what we are. I want to point out here that what you're seeing is not price per gallon in dollars. You're seeing price per liter in Turkish lira. So this really probably right now translates to about $9 a gallon. But that energy situation that we are now hearing so much about is exactly what they're hearing about, because they didn't really invest in mass transit. They went the same way we did, which is to say the internal combustion engine and the road system. And so now we're facing an interesting situation together. Okay, well, I'm going to just end it right about there. That's it. And if you have any specific questions, we'll do our best to try to answer them.
You've been listening to Alex and Irene Bortnick, April Seske, and John Trampush, four Anchorage School District teachers discussing the teacher study tour they took to Turkey this past summer. Recorded Friday, October 3rd, 2008 at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska. Through the Turkish Cultural Foundation and the Alaska World Affairs Council, Mr. and Mrs. Bortnik, Professor Seski, and Mr. Trampush visited Turkey with a group of teachers from all over the United States in an effort to enhance their classroom curriculum and develop a better understanding of Turkey, its people, culture, and history. After sharing how they plan to incorporate the trip into their Anchorage classrooms, the teachers responded to questions from the audience. Mr. Trampush spoke about the highway system and the many trucks in Turkey, relating their transportation system to the United States. An audience member wondered, do they have rail systems in Turkey? Mr. Trampush responded first, followed by Mrs. Bortnik.
I'm sure there's a rail system, but it didn't seem to be very developed, and I didn't cross many railroad tracks. We didn't see much about a railway system.
Yeah, our guide, Orhan, was very proud of the fact that Istanbul has a subway system that goes exactly 1 kilometer. He mentioned it several times.
While touring the schools of Turkey, did you get a chance to look at any of the textbooks? Specifically, did you see how the teachers taught about Armenian genocide or the massacres of Greek populations during World War I? The audience member asked, how is Turkey dealing with these ghosts? Mr. Bortnik responded.
There is a whole industry showing that that never happened. sometimes it's almost a criminal offense. There are a number of good books at LUSAC, some written by Turkish professors who are now teaching at American universities, dealing with that issue. And there's going to be a very good, interesting discussion at World Affairs on Friday, the 17th of October, on that very topic. But we actually did have one lecture, and I should just mention for 20 seconds. They went into that, and so we have the Turkish view of that. Bottom line, in their view, it was not a not an intentional extermination. It was a removal of a population from a war zone because that population had, to some extent, been involved in attacking the Turkish army, these were regular troops or so forth. So their view is that they removed these people to another part of the empire, not very efficiently, and a large number died. Now, whether intentionally, not intentionally, depends on your point of view.
Some people think Turkey will never be admitted to the European Union because it's a Muslim country. What are your thoughts on that? An audience member asked. Professor Seski responded first, followed by Mr. Trampush.
Actually, I asked that question to the former Turkish ambassador, and he pointed out that he thought that because Turkey is 98% Islamic, that it would be a good addition to the European Union, which is predominantly Christian at this time. He also thought that there, for a couple of reasons, it would be necessary for Turkey to join the EU, and he thinks it's only a matter of time. One of the reasons is because the population of Turkey is so young compared to Europe, and they're going to need the labor. I could go on, but he was very optimistic that in the future Turkey would join the European Union.
It may take a little time, but he thinks it's going to happen.
Did you see any other teachers from other parts of Alaska, other states, or other countries as part of your entourage? Another audience member asked. Mr. Bortnik responded first, followed by Mr. Trampush.
We traveled as part of a group of 28 teachers. There were 4 teachers from a state, 7 states. There were 2 other groups of approximately 28 that came later in the summer after us. So there's, you know, about 80 teachers that went this year on this program, and it's going to be expanded for next summer.
Yeah, and it really was a great opportunity to talk to other teachers from around the United States, and that was a surprising benefit that I hadn't even thought about before I went.
As an Islamic state, did you see any militant Islamic fundamentalists in Turkey? Another audience member asked. Mr. Trampush responded.
Well, they kept us out of the eastern part of the country. I mean, there wasn't a lot of time, so it would have been hard to do it. But the east is definitely a hotter zone with more conflict and more tension. When we were walking around and when we were visiting places, it really appeared that the Turks were pretty much at ease with each other. I tried to show some slides where you could tell there were a lot of traditional Islamic people and modernized secular Turks, but they seemed to be very comfortable in each other's presence. That being said, the day we left Ankara, there was a bombing at the American embassy, so there's something happening.
Last, an audience member asked, did you visit any national parks in Turkey? Mrs. Bortnick responded first, followed by Mr. Trampush.
I don't know about national parks, but one thing, even though Istanbul has approximately 12 million people, I did not feel sort of hemmed in. There were open spaces and parks and greenery all around. I felt much more in an urban setting in Ankara, which had only 4 million people, because there weren't those open spaces. Istanbul seemed much more planned with that in mind. There were places for children to play.
We didn't get to visit many national parks. That's something that would have interested me very much. But I can comment that there was a lot of beautiful, beautiful country. The Sea of Marmara, both sides of it, Cappadocia, the Aegean coast. There were so many beautiful places that I thought it would be good to go back and just do that very thing, because there really is some beautiful land there.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Turkish Travels, Traumas, and Triumphs. Selected to participate in the Teacher Study Tour to Turkey, sponsored by the Turkish Cultural Foundation and the Alaska World Affairs Council, Alex and Irene Bortnick, John Trampush, and April Suski spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, October 3rd. To find out more about the next Teacher Study Tour to Turkey program, or to view photos presented by the Anchorage teachers, visit our website, kska.org. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.